think you are not making this a life. Month. I mean, I realize the value of solitude, but yet you must be with other people, and, you know, I can't avoid community.
Well, I think the young man has asked a question. I'll just repeat it. He asked what kind of relationship in the lay life, when you're not leading a Trappist-like life, should there be between solitude and socialization? I think this depends entirely upon your vocation as a human being. One of the things that Merton stressed when he became a hermit was that this didn't mean that anybody else should become a hermit, that this was his vocation, and that each of us has a different vocation. The thing to do is to find it and to live it. What he did stress very strongly was that since a great many people do not know themselves and do not know the kind of things that you can learn only in silence and solitude, was that you should give yourself a chance to discover these things. In other words, take the time to learn what these things can teach you and then act on the overflow of what they teach you and what they form in you. But he himself would have deplored the idea that anyone should imitate him. He believed in a man's, in individual vocations and in a man's living his vocation individually. One of the first students who was doing a doctoral thesis came to see me at the Hermitage, and the first thing he said was, I'll tell you the truth. He said, I want to be exactly like Merton. And I said, well, then you don't know anything about Merton, because he would have been horrified at the idea of someone's, well, he would want you to be exactly like yourself, you know, and not like him. So I think, you know, what life tends to make us do is simply overlook. We become so busy and we become so preoccupied with making our way that we tend simply to bypass the time to spend with ourselves, to come to know what we are, to come to know what these things can teach us. And I think, you know, his urging would be that one be encouraged to do that, and for however long it takes. And then he said, first become and then do. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And he makes a very, to me, it was very stunning that Johnny remarked after knowing Salisbury from his reading, he said, if it ever came to a pitched battle between his craving for solitude and his craving to socialize with his friends, the craving for socializing with his friends would win out.
I don't agree with Father Hughes. He and I have talked about this a great deal. I don't believe he's correct in that, although I certainly respect, I disagree with him very much. There had to be, Merton was not a total solitary. He had two, he loved people too much. And on the Asian trip, he was talking with one of the Buddhists, and it was a man he respected very profoundly. And this man said a very simple thing to him, which came kind of like a light. He said, why do you think you have to be one or the other? He said, why not spend 9 months in a really total solitude and then spend 3 months sharing what you've learned from that solitude? And he felt that perhaps this was the key to what his future would be, you know, if he had lived. He agreed with the Buddhist monk. He felt it was almost a revelation that there was such an obvious, simple answer that he hadn't stumbled onto it himself, you know. And so he, in fact, he wrote his abbot this, and as you know, maybe this seems to make really sense when you've got this kind of didn't have to be the one or the other. Could be both. And certainly his preference would have been for a longer period of solitude than and a shorter period of sharing the fruits of that solitude with others.
Mm-hmm.
Really what I was suggesting there was that he was a man who took terrible gambles to be true. This vocation, he was constantly leaping over cliffs in the spiritual life, you know, that took great, great courage, because he had every facility for taking it the easy way, and he never did. I didn't mean that insofar as the externals of his life is concerned, because the externals of his life appear to be enormously contradictory, and he didn't discourage this appearance of contradictoriness. He liked to not have people be able to put their finger on it and say this and this and this, you know, and he felt that just pure consistency represented a limited view. So I didn't mean it in that sense. What I meant was in the sense that he never wavered from taking the deeper and the deeper leap, no matter what the external appearances were. And when you see his intimate life, this represents a kind of constant daring.
I couldn't hear very well the sister at the conference that gave him a hard time. Could you go over that a little bit and what he meant by it?
Well, what he was saying, of course, is that there's too many people prattling cliches that they haven't tested in their own lives about the spiritual life and about Christianity and about Christ. And Lord knows, you know, you can hardly hear a thing or pick up any kind of a writing where this doesn't just slap you in the face. It's the same old stuff which you feel is memorized parroting. And so this is the kind of thing. You know, he says, we're putting off the young. You know, we're saying these things and we are not in any way living in a way that gives any evidence that we actually feel them. We're saying them off the top of our heads. And the point he was really making, he'd just been with the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama told him quite frankly that one of the reasons that the lamaseries fell was that they insisted on being secure and they insisted on being solvent, and said that, you know, we weren't authentically poor, we take vows of poverty, we weren't authentically poor. And so Merton was facing his group with that, and what the Dalai Lama says is now it's got to be everybody for himself. And Merton was saying, you know, we cannot go on with these rich structures preaching poverty, preaching sacrifice, preaching all of these things, even though as individuals within that monastic community we may live in great poverty and so on and so forth. And it was a point that later, of course, began to be brought out in the open when the finances of some of these orders were made known to the members within those communities, and the members were quite shocked to find out that they were extremely solvent and now started getting rid of all of that kind of securities and blue chip stocks and things like that. And so what he was saying is that, you know, we're losing a whole generation of people who are telling us to put up or shut up. And I'm putting it much more crudely than he did, although he put it, you know, pretty bluntly. And so what the sister, what she understood him to say, well, he said, we've got to stop talking these cliches about Christ and, you know, show by our actions that we really believe them. And so what she had apparently misunderstood him, so she was that we should stop talking about Christ. And so she went to Father de Grun and said, you know, after all these years of training, that we should go out and preach Christ to mankind. He's telling us to shut up, you know. And so de Grun went and told Merton what she'd said, and Merton said, well, I explained myself very badly. I'm sure what I really meant was that, you know, we have first to become so permeated with Christ that the overflow then comes from that, and we don't need to say anything. That our very actions, what we are, will cast their resonances out. And that's what he had meant to imply, but she hadn't understood it that way. He had become very sensitive also in his later years. He had become enormously sensitive to he never had a chance to write a great deal about this publicly, but he'd become enormously sensitive to the kind of missionary activity which destroyed a local culture. I've been doing a great deal of work for the Canadian government in the last couple of years on what they call the problem of the Canadian Indian. And one of the things that has struck me the strongest has been the, you see, those of us who are Catholics and who know a little bit about history have always viewed the Jesuits in Canada and their work with the Indians, they made martyrs, they were heroic in their sacrifice. And yet the one group that is most despised by Canadian Indians today are the Jesuits, who claim that they came in and walked roughshod over what were cultural values to the Indians and simply tried to turn them into imitation French or Anglo-Saxon Christians, which would have been all right, except that they murdered a local culture in the process. And this ends up being profoundly degrading to any people, the idea that we in this country still have, you know, Indian and Negro missions, that kind of an idea, was something that he was becoming terribly sensitized to toward the end of his life. And this also was implicit in that final statement of his. And he had developed himself a very profound way of liberating himself from the imprisoning aspects of a given culture. Sacrifice the security of a cultural formation. You know, it's quite an easy thing to do if you know how to do it. And he was more and more open to this. This is the reason why after his death I got, and particularly after the publication of Ed Wright's book, I got letters weekly, telephone calls weekly, from people who thought that his openness to Eastern and Indian religions implied an abandonment of Christianity, that he had left the church, you know. And I got some extraordinary letters. I got a letter from one little sister who said, thank God, God took him in time, you know, that kind of thing. And because this just represents a total misunderstanding of his vision and his view and his openness and his respect for the other. Yes. I think probably you'd almost have to have contact with him to perceive what I'm trying to say. Probably his incredible ability to empathize, particularly with people who suffered. This was also shown, you know, a lot of great people sought him out. Kind of people that would flatter most people to know. And there's no question but what Merton had a great many friends who were famous and whom he loved. And yet the things that most preoccupied him were, you know, taking Christmas trees at Christmas on a truck and going to the nearby hospitals and setting them up in hospital rooms. He was deeply moved by the problems of Appalachian children who didn't have much chance for an education, who didn't have much chance to get out of a kind of an earthbound existence. And these were things where, even at the very end of his life, he would turn down a chance to be with someone whom he would really enjoy to be with. He would got to where he couldn't possibly handle his mail. But anyone who wrote him in trouble always got an answer. He just made no distinction between relationships that were flattering or enriching and those that weren't. And I think this is probably as good an answer as I know to your question. I don't know if it's a satisfactory one, because as I say, you were overwhelmed by this when you were in his presence. I've often said that I started out to do this research by going around and interviewing friends, close friends. And one of the things that I very quickly learned is that each friend had a different Merton. And this didn't mean that Merton falsified himself in relation to anybody. It was that he was so transparent in his fixing of his attention on you that you really got an almost mirror image from him. And I find people that really know him, and they aren't kidding and they aren't exaggerating, but who only know one facet of him, because he revealed you back to yourself, which is an extraordinary gift, you know, and he had it. So what I've really had to do is stop relying, except for anecdotal materials, on people who knew him, and rely almost entirely on the private writings. Yes. Huh?
Quite a question, I guess.
It's a very uncomfortable question for me to try to answer. I don't think my relationship with Thomas Merton had any effect on me as a professional person. I don't see that it did at all. He was a great comfort in my life. It was marvelous in a time when we were both taking extremely unpopular positions, to have each other to fall on, to support each other. I counted down, to be very frankly, I was cast into a role which is very far into my nature, which is an extremely activist role, which is absolutely far into my nature. And it was the awareness that there were people like him who didn't have to be out in these alleys that I was in, who gave me the strength to go and be there. And it was that kind of thing. It wasn't I couldn't have done what I did. I wouldn't have had the physical strength. I wouldn't have had anything to be able to go on doing that kind of work had it not been for people like him who were back there doing what I wished I could have been doing. I don't know if that's a good answer or not. It's the kind of question I can't answer, really. Yes?
I'd like to ask, is it especially privileged to have all these visitors? That isn't the rule, is it, for monks to be having visitors from the outside?
The rule, actually, the time that he went in was that you could have your family. Let's see, who was the young man that? Yeah, what could you have once a year? Once a year, a 3-day visit. That still holds, although there are now all kinds of things that are permitted. What you have to realize is that it was realized very early that Merton was extraordinary. The abbot himself told me, said, I realized very quickly that I was dealing with a genius, and I didn't know how to deal with a genius. And so in charity, a lot of people came to Merton, or came to the abbey seeking help. And Merton was a great master of souls. He didn't like this kind of thing particularly. He didn't like to give direction except to fellow monks. But first it came to be that sort of thing. He was probably the most immeasurably cultivated man on a wide range of activities at that time, and so he was constantly being called for this. But you remember that after he became very famous in the Seven-Story Mountain, he himself was overwhelmed by this kind of visits, and he got permission just to send out cards in response to this huge mail that he got. Toward the end, his visits concerned, that part of his vocation in which he was a professional. His publisher could come see him. I was working with him very, very constantly in the areas of racism and in the areas of photography. And so it got to where there was just no restrictions placed on these visits, although we tried to keep them as brief as possible. And he, other than that, he didn't receive a great many visitors. People couldn't just go there and ask to see Merton and have much hope of getting to see him. Now those things, if there's a good and valid and human reason why any monk can be seen. Yes.
At the end of the last few years, through the 60s, I think the rule was lifted very much for Merton because he became very active with ecumenical groups.
Yes.
And there were many Presbyterians and Baptist groups from Louisville and Lexington that wouldn't have permission to go out. But this was part of his ministry and something that he developed very, very much. And today, there are many of the monks at the monastery on Sundays are constantly receiving groups like this. So, you know, and I know it often does sound like he had company all the time, but it wasn't nearly as, you know, active as that. But the summer before he left for Baghdad, that June, the end of May through the middle of June, he had groups there almost every week because he wrote one time. We would go out with the children, which he always had us out for a picnic for them in May or June. And it was just hard doing it, and he had a group of nuns from somewhere. Do you remember the room where they came? And I got a letter from him telling, you know, saying all these people were in that. I think Ed Rice was there, wasn't he?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was people like this for the most part on a religious, you know.
There had to be a good, valid reason, but there were great. And of course, the number of people that wanted to see him, the number of people that finally got to see him was, you know, enormously small. He was doing. He had a conference for contemplative, dealing with the contemplative life, that kind of thing, heads of orders and things of that sort, which he would would consent to do. Well, they would bat around ideas. This was at a time when there was a growing kind of awareness on the part of many women religious that most of the rules made for them were made by men, and that you had to find ways to resolve those unrealistic situations. Was that tactful enough, foot?
Yes. What a thing, we were lucky we never had any men
touch one. One of the things that I think
question, but what
I
that's
mean,
the truth.
The head of our Merton Study Center is a Baptist minister, and the most active people in the Merton Ward in Louisville are seminary. Although, don't get me wrong, there are some Catholic priests, but it's the Protestants who, in our area, have been so terribly active and interested in Merton.
Well, they didn't have to be on the defensive with him, you know, and he didn't have to be on the defensive with them. It was a marvelous kind of communication that he established, and to which there was a great response, and I think that's about the best answer that I can give to you. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes?
It's been reported that there was some tension between Merton and his abbot, and also that most of his works were censored by the
situation.
Could you comment on that?
Yes. It's quite, to do this justice, you'd have to comment at greater length than I'm going to, but I'll, this was a great, Merton's feelings about his abbot were a great problem with Merton. The abbot is not a villain in this picture. These were men of such incredibly different backgrounds and tastes that even where they weren't in conflict about policy, you had a really extraordinarily ambivalent relationship. Merton had a thing about the abbot, and the abbot, as I say, didn't know how to take Merton. He felt that Merton, because of his loss of parents early in life, needed a strong hand to keep him still, to keep him quiet, to give him a chance to work. There, again, what you find constantly in the journals is two men equally sincere, equally convinced, equally bullheaded, if you can use that kind of term, whose tastes in everything and whose views of everything differed, who nevertheless had a great deal of respect for each other. They had, Merton was his abbot's confessor for a long time. These are things that people don't realize. They had sessions together every week. Very often the abbot would say things which, for his generation and his kind of spirituality, were the old things, and they were usually very pious-sounding things, and this would drive Merton up the wall. But again, it was largely and frequently a matter of taste. And then when Merton would do something, like I was talking about that hot July day when he stopped by. This was late in his vocation, when he stopped by the Sisters of Loretto. It was the same time that Life magazine came out with the selections from Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, and it was the same time that there was mass publication in Life magazine of actual photos of Merton. And for great, great numbers of people, this was the first time they'd ever seen the image of a man whom many of them had known by correspondence for many years. Well, Merton didn't get this copy of the magazine. The abbot reproached him for being a non-hermit, for becoming a non-hermit, and Merton couldn't quite figure out whether it was because he made this drop-in visit to the Sisters at Loretto or because of the publication in Life magazine, which the abbot knew about, because Life bought this, and at that time the abbey had to give its consent to that kind of thing. So there was constantly this kind of friction between the two men. And Merton would say, well, the abbot's found out about something, and he's going to give me hell, and I suppose I deserve it. And then he'd go down and he'd say, he couldn't have been nicer. You know, why do I always expect him to blast me? But he always anticipated, he had a kind of paranoia about anticipating that the abbot was really going to give it to him. And every time he did that, he'd come back and faithfully write in his journal, he couldn't have been nicer, he couldn't have been more sympathetic, you know. And you have this kind of thing. They were two men who, Merton didn't question the abbot's holiness, you know, but it was couched in a whole terminology and in a whole monastic concept that was really offensive and foreign to Merton's nature. Merton was a man who had little fear. You couldn't scandalize Merton. He read everything. His father had been an artist. He'd been everywhere. He'd seen everything. And he was not a prude. Those of you who are familiar with, I guess, any kind of monastic life, there's very careful screening of reading matter that might come in and create bad reactions, you know. And, for example, one of the priests there was a very fine artist and really an extraordinary monk. And so they arranged for him to receive an art volume, a volume of great paintings, to use as part of his conference materials. And when he finally got the book, nobody quite knows who did it, but every painting of a nude had been cut out of that book. You know, when you're dealing with highly cultivated human beings who aren't going to be, you know, greatly damaged by a painting of a nude. And things like that happened very frequently, and so a whole lot of what you hear, they weren't at each other's throats. They were. Merton was constantly reproaching himself because of the the fact that he always anticipated the abbot was going to do or say something, which the abbot most frequently didn't do or say. And it becomes a very touching kind of picture of two men with very, very little similarity that would allow them to communicate with one another, who wanted to be charitable to one another and who just rubbed each other the wrong way in so many things, but really largely in matters of taste, largely in matters of...
Was his trip to Bangkok that connected to the monastery, or was it the private...
No, this was again one of the great misconceptions that's been published. It was the idea that Merton was very worried about the money for that trip. Now, Merton could have had all kinds of extra things because simply people would have given it to him. He absolutely scrupled about having anything that every other monk didn't have. One of his friends there used to leave him little packages of goodies when he was a hermit, you know, and should leave him down and send up a little note that there's a package underneath the bridge down by the second turn in the path or something like this. And he finally wrote her a letter and said, look, you know, this is very sweet, but it humiliates me out of my mind. You should not do this for me. He said, I do not want what my brothers cannot have. When he became very, it became obvious that he was an enormously gifted photographer. I wrote him because I was processing his films. He said that he was getting very bad results, and he discovered that the brother that ran the dark room there was so unimpressed by his abstractions of tree roots that he was sending them to the drugstore for processing, and he wanted to know if I could handle them in my dark room. And so I said, of course. And then I wrote him, he didn't have a camera. He was borrowing anybody's camera that happened to be around. And so one week he would send me beautiful negatives with a Rolleiflex, and the next week, you know, some junk camera. And I wrote him, I said, you know, you're wasting too much. You've got an authentic gift. And why don't you, you have a typewriter. These are things for your work. Why don't you get a really first-class instrument that you can live with and learn to use? And he, Rick Banks, said, I probably could because my picture is beginning to sell for book jackets and things like that, but he said there is this problem of poverty and I just don't want to ask for such a thing. And you know, what you must realize also is that his income, the income that he brought into that abbey was, you know, quite enormous over his lifetime, and there wouldn't have been any question he would have gotten what he needed to work with. And so finally I resolved it. I said, well, you know, why can't I lend you in perpetuity a good camera and a good set of lenses? And so he accepted that, but put it in his will that this was to be returned, it was only a loan and so forth. And so the I think I've gotten away from the Bangkok thing. Oh yes, so what he was worried about, he did not want to take money from the abbey for that kind of a trip. One of the books talked about him, says that they kept him in a constant state of worry. Well, I have all the correspondence about that trip. Heaven knows, Merton, his books and his royalties brought great amounts of money into the monastery. There was no question about financing his trip. He was the one who did the worrying. He was the one who scrupled about this. And so he thought to pay for that trip, he would keep journals, and he planned on publishing two books about his Eastern experience to pay for the trip, you see. But all the time he was writing back, I'm worried about this and that and the other, and every letter back was, you know, you don't worry, you spend what you need to spend, you do what you need to do, and there's no problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That summer before he left, he was really get to one day, he came in for shots or something. And I'm not literary in any way, shape, or form. And these magazines and so forth that he wrote for, you know, I have nothing to do with. And he said, Tommy, he said, listen, do you know of any good magazine that might like to preprint to write an article on my trip to Asia?
Yeah.
And what do you mean? He said, well, you know, to get some money to sort of pay off for this Asian trip. And I got annoyed with him very often. You know, we were good friends and I spoke kind of roughly. And I said, damn it, you don't have to even worry about that. The monastery's paying for that trip, aren't they?
well, yeah, but, you know, I hate to ask them. And I was really annoyed about here he's worrying about asking them for money. And they were giving, there was no problem.
No problem whatsoever. He was not sent for his own good pleasure. He wasn't sent for his own good pleasure. He was sent as the representative of the abbot. If the abbot had gone, the abbey would have certainly paid for it, and there would have been any question about any of this, you see. It was, that, again, these are things that come up in some of the writings about Merton, about people who don't understand what that situation was. Yes?
Could you speak to the problem of censorship?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. The problem of censorship was... Let me see how I can put it. Very early, when Merton was a quite famous writer already, probably the time of the writing of The Sign of Jonas, after he'd done Siege of Contemplation, after he'd done Seven Story, he submitted The Sign of Jonas to the censors, to the order censors. These things always passed the local censors. And at that time, now this just shows the kind of evolution that's taken place, it was considered that a contemplative should think only about certain things, that a contemplative should not reveal very much about his personal life, his intimate life. And so at the level of the order censors in France, this was turned down. Bob Giroux appealed to Jacques Maritain, who read it and who wrote a lengthy and very beautiful letter saying that he felt that the last portion of The Sign of Jonas was certainly one of the greatest things that he'd ever read. And it was largely through his intervention that that book was published. But then you would get these things that kept a man like Merton pretty humble. You'd get the suggestion from the monastic censor, from the order censor, that he should take a correspondence course in grammar and punctuation because he wasn't sufficiently, you know, he was literally illiterate. And the whole correspondence dealing with his writings, as I say, was of a kind designed to keep him very humble, and to everyone else it's going to look pretty strange and pretty ridiculous. Actually, when the later books came, his books on peace had some problems with the monastic censor, with the abbot general. And then when Pope John 23rd issued Pacem in Terris, Merton wrote a quite priceless letter to the abbot general, and he said, "All I can say is that it's a good thing that you're not the censor for the Holy Father, because," he said, "now that he said these same things that I've been saying, how about letting me come out and say them, you see?" And he got a very ugly letter back, a very strict letter back, saying that you don't know anything about peace, you're incompetent in this area, and you shouldn't even be thinking about this kind of, you know, subterranean thoughts and that sort of thing. So you have a lot that's blisteringly ridiculous in this. Again, as I say, toward the end, the American censor was Paul Bourne. He just automatically passed. He wouldn't even insult Merton by giving them a reading. He just automatically passed them.
Is there any problem, for instance, if the things were edited out, if there'll be additions in the future which will be put back in, that were edited out at the level of the order?
No, I think nearly all of that has already been, it's found other ways out. It's found other ways out. When Merton would go into the, you see, there was no, he could publish by mimeographing. He could mimeograph anything he wanted to as long as it wasn't published. So he would mimeograph and send these things. I got six books of his that they turned down. And when he would go into the hospital or go and see the doctor, well, he'd take these in, go into the public library in Louisville and sneak them into the shelves. You know, these were these bound mimeograph books of his. And he'd give them in conferences, and then they'd get in the public domain, and they'd go right on. So nothing was ever really lost. It all came out in some other form. In fact, he felt it was providential that some of the things were because it gave him a chance to rework them. And in the forms in which they finally appeared, they were much better than the way they'd been in the first place. But this doesn't undo the fact that there were all kinds of strange, incompetent judgments passed.
Some of the letters that I've been reading in the cases, he has rambling sentences, goes on and on and on. It seems rather strange. It doesn't seem really like a good literary style. It's just going and going.
Well, I think, you know, Merton himself, in his prose work, certainly had no use for himself as a stylist. He would be absolutely the first one to lament the qualities. You know, can I write that badly? That kind of thing. He was extremely humble about that. But he wrote with enormous speed. You look at the quantity of the work that he put out in his short life. It's incredible. And he would write things in first draft, and then he'd take a different color ink and make the corrections, and then hope he could find somebody to type it up for him, and then he'd make some more corrections on the type thing and go on. And some of the people who really were tactful in the church would write him and say, you know, this is the ideas are marvelous, they're rich, but couldn't you take a little more time and present them in a little better chronology, a little better sequence, so that your thought is clarified a little bit better? He just made no pretense of being a literary stylist, except when he was writing poetry or something of that sort. Yes?
What were Father Lewis's own thoughts on the inner search in the sense of how he would evaluate it and its importance?
He hardly mentions. The only mentions he makes is that he has been, that he is so far unsatisfied with it. He keeps bringing it out and redoing it. And of course, that was one of the two books that in his will he specified should not be published, because he was not satisfied with what he was doing with it. He never was it was an important book to him, but he was never content with what he had managed to do with it. Yes.
It's also reported that Merton fretted quite a bit about his own death for quite a bit of time.
Fretted about it?
Yeah. Uh-huh. He was concerned about it.
Merton had kind of an overwhelming premonition that he would die young. He had good reason to have that premonition, because he had a great many things physically wrong with him. He was in his last years, from 66, when he went in for what was really the first major surgery, and it was spinal surgery. His journals are quite touching about this, because he, in one sense, he was a very tough-minded man, and there was also a growth in his abdomen at that same time. And this lumbar disc problem was causing his hands to go numb, and was causing his legs to go numb, and it was very painful. And so he went in, and he had finally waited very, very late before he went in and had it examined, and it turned out that surgery just had to be. And this could have been, it wasn't any guarantee that this was all they were going to find. And so in those, they gave him about a month. I believe he went in on the 4th of March, and the surgery was, he was scheduled to go in the hospital the 23rd and to be operated on the 25th. And so he came back and had to get himself accustomed to the idea. Of course, he loathed the whole idea of hospitals. He loathed the whole idea of being at somebody else's mercy. And so he came out and he began to handle it by doing a lot of physical work. And he would say, I spent the afternoon in the woods. I'm trying to set my house in order. But he says, when it comes to preparing myself for what might now be the beginning of the end, I find I have no good ideas at all. when he wasn't in actual danger, he had quite beautiful ideas. If you'll remember in Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, he was talking about a dream that he associated with his death. It was a dream where he was walking toward a center, and he didn't know just where it was, and he ended up on a high place looking down across the bay or an arm of a harbor. And that, to him, represented a premonition of death. And in that, you know, he was really happy. And in, as the time approached for him to enter this surgery, in which he didn't know whether it was the beginning, because there was a lot of things wrong with him besides the disc, he finally became quite beautiful about it, that this is God's will and this is what he wants. And finally, at the very end, he's going into surgery, and it early in the morning, he gets up at 3, and he wraps up the quarter of a pound of oleo that's left to take down to the Abbey. And there's a couple of eggs left, so he cooks them, although he's not hungry, so that that won't be left to waste. And he hears the bells from the Abbey calling for conventual mass at 6 o'clock. And he's all ready to go. And he says he's leaving the place. If he doesn't come back, he's leaving it in terribly good hands. They've got a marvelous musicologist. They've got very fine men there. It's a good community. And that he said, if I must now die, the one thing I regret are the years of solitude that I might have had. That's the way he went into surgery, with that kind of an attitude. Of course, there were then other degenerating discs, and he was plagued with bursitis. And there were an awful lot of things. So he had good reason to be preoccupied with death in the last 2 or 3 years of his life. And he was.